evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. The purported remains of some U.S. troops killed during the Korean conflict have been returned. Vice President Pence credited North Korean leader Kim Jong-un with fulfilling a promise to return the remains of some U.S. troops killed during the Korean conflict, a step that he said showed tangible progress toward easing tensions on the Korean Peninsula. I use the word purported because the remains still have to be examined and verified. During their meeting in Singapore, both Chairman Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump committed to recovering remains of U.S. service members who died during the Korean conflict and whose bodies were never found. More than 7,700 U.S. troops who fought in Korea remain unaccounted for. About 5,300 were lost in what is now North Korea. The fact that these remains have been returned to the U.S. after all of this time is a very good thing. The fact that Chairman Kim and President Trump were able to sit down and agree to make this happen is a very good thing. Hopefully, more good things will continue to occur. I have just one issue with this, and it's the optics of Vice President Pence meeting the return of the remains instead of President Trump. Trump is the commander-in-chief, not Pence. For the families of these fallen soldiers, this is a very, very, very big deal. For this country, this is a very big deal. I think Trump, as president and commander-in-chief, should have been there instead of campaigning in Tampa with Q quacks. That's just me. The Senate sends a $717 billion defense bill to Trump. Yesterday, the Senate cleared and sent to President Trump a $717 billion defense policy bill aimed at building up the military and blunting Chinese foreign investment and telecommunications technology. The final vote on the fiscal 2019 National Defense Authorization Act was 87-10. House lawmakers passed the bill by a vote of 351-66. In all, the bill would authorize a $717 billion national defense budget top line, including $616.9 billion for the base Pentagon budget and $21.9 billion for nuclear weapons programs under the Energy Department. Another $69 billion would be authorized to fund U.S. war efforts under the Overseas Contingency Operations Account. Now, that $21.9 billion for nuclear weapons programs really, to me, stands out because President Trump, while meeting with Mr. Kim Jong-un, was talking about denuclearization. President Obama was talking about, during his administration, denuclearization. And now here the United States is going to spend $21.9 billion for nuclear weapons programs. That, to me, is just atrocious. Now, here's a big problem with our politics: hypocrisy. Representative John Garamendi, Democrat from California, is on record as saying, quote, "This bill pushes us even further and faster down the path to war, toward a new nuclear arms race." Does it make sense, or does it make us safer to have a low-yield nuclear weapon on one of our submarines? Probably not. But here's the thing. Garamendi voted for the bill. All of that chatter, he goes on record making that very clear, sensible statement. Does it make us safer to have a low-yield nuclear weapon on one of our submarines? Probably not. And he's absolutely right. And then he votes for the bill. I believe the budgets are numeric representations of priority. In these days and times with infrastructure crumbling, homelessness, public schools underfunded, this country decides to spend $717 billion on strengthening its war footing. This is lunacy. The Pope declares death penalty unacceptable in all cases. Pope Francis has declared that the death penalty is wrong in all cases. This is a definitive change in church teaching that is likely to challenge faithful Catholic politicians, judges, and officials in the United States and other countries who have argued that their church was not entirely opposed to capital punishment. Francis said executions were unacceptable in all cases because they are an attack on the inviolability and dignity of the person. The Vatican announced this today. The church also says it will work with determination for the abolition of capital punishment worldwide. Over 2,800 people sit on death row in the United States. 14 executions are scheduled for the remainder of this year. The Pope eliminated a clear contradiction in Catholic teaching, pro-life on the birth side and finding that the death penalty was acceptable on the other side. I found the Pontiff's declaration to be incredibly timely in that this past Tuesday, an Arizona man, Barry Lee Jones, had his conviction thrown out after spending 23 years on death row. Federal Judge Timothy Burgess wrote in a 91-page order that the verdict in Jones's 1995 trial was the product of a rush to judgment by law enforcement whose lack of due diligence and thorough professional investigation was compounded by the failures of Jones's defense attorneys. Absent such failures, he wrote, there is a reasonable probability that his jury would not have convicted him of any of the crimes with which he was charged and previously convicted. Burgess ordered that Jones be immediately retried or released. Because of the school-to-prison pipeline, overworked and incompetent counsel, and rushes to judgment by law enforcement, American prisons are filled with innocent individuals. The Arizona Attorney General's office has defended Jones's conviction, even as its theory of the crime has fallen apart. Prosecutors fought to preserve Jones's conviction, relying on procedural barriers while showing indifference to the grave flaws in the case. This is also another huge problem with the system. Prosecutors who are more concerned with their conviction record than with justice. They rather rely on procedural barriers to keep an innocent man in prison and possibly execute him. The Pope is right on this one. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. As I mentioned in the previous segment, Pope Francis has declared that the death penalty is wrong in all cases, a definitive change in church teaching, and this past Tuesday, an Arizona man, Barry Lee Jones, had his conviction thrown out after spending 23 years on death row. Over 2,800 people sit on death row in the United States, and 14 executions, I believe, are scheduled for the remainder of this year. What is the war on drugs and harsher sentencing policies, including mandatory minimum sentences, done to the American prison process? To get insight into this, we turn to my next guests. My first one is a director of strategic initiatives and oversees the sentencing project's federal advocacy work and develops special projects and partnerships to advance the organizational mission of reducing mass incarceration. She's a co-author of the newly released report by the Sentencing Project entitled Capitalizing on Mass Incarceration, U.S. Growth in Private Prisons, Kara Gotch. Welcome to The Critical Hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
And did I pronounce your name properly?
That's right.
Thank you. Okay, I was practicing. We're also joined by Archbishop George Augustus Stallings, the founder of the Imani Temple African American Catholic Congregation in Washington, D.C. Archbishop Stallings, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you very much, my brother, Dr. Wilmer Leon. It's great being with you on Sputnik News Radio and to be with my sister, Kara Gotch. We have not yet met, but I feel like I know her because we're on the same page.
Well, Kara, let me tell you, if you're on the same page as Archbishop Stallings, you're on the right page.
I believe it.
I understand that the issue of the death penalty is a standalone issue, but with that being said, Carl, let's start with you. What's your take on the number of Barry Lee Joneses that are languishing on American death rows in judiciousness of the American criminal justice system, or what I call the American criminal injustice system?
Well, we know from past experience that hundreds of people have been exonerated from death row because years after their conviction and sentence, they've been found to be innocent. I think that is certainly an incredible indictment of our system of capital punishment in this country. The fear, the reality that someone can easily be executed and have never committed a crime, I think weighs on a lot of folks, and it should, and has helped to contribute to the declining support for the death penalty in this country.
You know, to your point, it was back, I think, in 2003 when former Illinois Governor George Ryan commuted 167 inmates, the sentences of 167, and that was all the way back in 2003. And he caught hell for doing that as a Republican. Oh, he caught hell for doing that. The same question to you, Archbishop Stallings, and if you could talk about what this really means for yourself as a former Catholic priest, what does it mean for the Pope to have come out and made this blanket change in church doctrine?
What is very clear to me, Dr. Leon and Cara, is that the current leader of the Roman Catholic Church, His Holiness Pope Francis, is mirroring the heart of the Christian message. That he literally is portraying himself as the embodiment of Jesus the Christ in taking the stance in regards to the respect of human life. The Roman Catholic Church for decades, has promoted the whole concept of the sanctity of life. And a lot of that emphasis has been on the abortion issue. But one cannot speak so clearly on that subject and not have a consistent life or a consistent ethic of life approach. You cannot talk about sparing the life of the unborn if you don't talk about sparing the life of persons who, as the church teaches, embodies the image and likeness of God. So no matter what the crime is, no matter what the sentence is for a person who has committed some type of crime, many times, you know, they may be guilty, and we've seen many exceptions where they were not guilty and they were put to death unjustly. So my whole approach, I applaud Pope Francis. I thank God that he has spoken unequivocally in stating the new doctrine. This is a clear-cut new doctrine for Roman Catholicism. No death penalty is acceptable in any way, shape, or form, regardless. That is a bold stance that is going to shake the Roman Catholic Church to its foundations. And it's going to really stir a major debate in Catholic circles in America, particularly between conservatives and liberals.
Thank you for that analysis, Archbishop Stallings, because, Cara, that takes me to my next question to you before we get to the specifics of your new report. And that is, what do you think that does politically with Catholic politicians, Catholic judges and officials who have argued for a very long time or have refused to take a side on this issue? Because they say, up to this point, the Catholic Church has not been opposed to capital punishment.
Well, I definitely think it ramps up the political pressure on those politicians to acknowledge what the Pope is saying and calling on. I mean, obviously, it's no secret to most politicians and Catholic politicians that the Catholic Church has been vocal in opposition generally to capital punishment. This latest declaration, you know, takes that a step further. not allowing for any sort of exemption in use of the death penalty. And I think that's really critical. And I think I would hope that the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and other leaders in the U.S. Catholic leadership will go to the Congress and communicate this strong position to say, hey, we need to do something about this and something needs to be done.
It won't only impact Catholics, I think. It'll also put pressure on those who call themselves Christians, such as Mike Pence and so many others who are supposed to be such devout Christians, even though they don't follow the teachings of the Catholic Church. The Pope is still a pretty good guy. I mean, a pretty big guy in the hierarchy of Christianity. We'll see what this does, not only in terms of Catholics, but what this does across the board. Bishop Stallings, any thought on that point?
Yes, Dr. Leon, this goes beyond Catholicism as far as what Jesus teaches. It's what we call Christianity, the Christian foundation of our faith. Someone like Vice President Pence is a Christian. He doesn't have to be Catholic to understand what Jesus said in the scriptures in Matthew's gospel: offer the evil man no resistance. It's very clear where Jesus stands on the issue of capital punishment, even though those words are not used. He talks about loving your enemy. He talks about forgiving those who have harmed you, doing good to those who persecute you. So this is an issue that really goes beyond Catholicism. It goes to the very heart of Christianity and to the core of a lot of world religion. That to talk about the death penalty is tantamount to saying we are the ones who judge life. We are the ones who sit in judgment over life and death issues. And we do not create life in the context of what we understand as believers, as Christians, and other world religions. God or the supreme power is the author or the creator of all things. We don't have, we say in Job, the prophet Job, he said, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. We don't take away life. We don't have that right to take another person's life, regardless of the circumstance or situation. So I want to see where people like Pence. The other thing, Dr. Leon and Kara, is this. The person who has been recommended by President Trump for the Supreme Court to replace Justice Kennedy, mm-hmm. a Roman Catholic. I want to see in the interrogation progress before the Senate if Judge Kavanaugh is going to be asked about Pope Francis's latest doctrinal decree.
That's a great question.
Not an opinion. It's not an opinion.
No, you're right.
He's not. This is doctrine, as you said. This is a teaching now of the Roman Catholic Church. I want to see if any of those senators will ask Judge Kavanaugh where he will stand if the issue of capital punishment comes up, knowing that he's a Roman Catholic, and where does he stand on that position?
That's a great point. That's a great point. Kara, you are the co-author of Capitalizing on Mass Incarceration, U.S. Growth in Private Prisons. What was the motivation behind your doing this report?
Well, over the last 16 years, we've seen that private prisons are growing five times faster than the overall prison population. And we're in an interesting time in that there is bipartisan consensus across the country, both at the federal level and at the state level, in the need to address our criminal justice system, including our system of sentencing. And there has finally, after 40 years of unprecedented growth in our incarcerated population, a leveling off. But we haven't seen that leveling off in prison privatization. And that's troubling to me and to my organization because we are very concerned about introducing the profit incentives into incarceration, right? Probably one of the most serious functions of government is its ability to take away liberty from its citizens. And we never want to see an instance where there is a profit incentive to do that. But with prison privatization, that's very much the reality. There's a history of for-profit corporations like CoreCivic, which is formerly Corrections Corporation of America, and Geo Group, which are the two largest private prison corporations in the country, seeking harsher penalties. And we know that in certain states like New Mexico and Montana, There is a long history of financing politicians and campaigns who are supportive of their industry, and they have managed to infiltrate their correction systems to the tune of about 40% of the state's prison population are housed in private prisons, despite the fact that there is reams of evidence and research that these companies do not save the state money in incarceration costs, that in fact they have poor their staff or have less training and less experience, they're underpaid, and they're as a result, there are higher incidents of violence and abuse within those facilities. Just recently, in the last few years, we saw a government accountability office report on private prisons at the federal level, which mirrored those findings we've seen for years now, that the private federal facilities had higher instances of prisoner-on-prisoner abuse, staff-on-prisoner abuse, higher incidents of illegal contraband within institutions, higher use of solitary confinement than in public institutions. And it moved the then Obama administration to phase out the use of private prisons. And it corresponded with a time where the prison population was actually declining and had been for several years. And so there was more flexibility to move people from the private prisons into public institutions. Well, now, since there's been a change in administration, with the Trump administration coming into office, that policy has been reversed. And in fact, there's been a doubling down on the use of private prisons. New RFPs, requests for contract proposals, have come from the administration, not just for federal prisoners, but also for immigration detention. And so we anticipate that there will be a ramping up of the use of private prisons, particularly at the federal level. And that's something we're very much concerned about.
You have some incredibly eye-opening statistics in your report. You say the United States has the world's largest private prison population. Of the 1.5 million people in state and federal prisons in 2016, 8.5% were incarcerated in private prisons, or 128,063. Another 26,249, or 73% of all people in immigration detention, were confined in privately run facilities. From 2000 to 2016, the number of people housed in private prisons increased 5 times faster than the total prison population over a similar time frame. The proportion of people detained in private immigration facilities increased by 442%. This rise in the use of private facilities really seems to be right in parallel with this whole neoliberal shift in American politics and this whole idea of less government and more use of the private sector to perform government previously determined government assigned responsibilities.
Numbers are staggering in Kaur's report in her study. And to know that not only are those numbers so high, but we are also seeing an industry, namely the prison industrial complex, being funded and being one of the most powerful expansions in industry in our nation, that we're sending people to prison unnecessarily in many instances. And not only that, but when you look at the prison population, it is so disproportionately minority that when you look at the population of African Americans, Latinos, Hispanics, et cetera, and see their percentage of the population in the United States, and then see the gross proportionate number that are in prison, it's staggering and it's alarming. And somebody is getting rich off of really putting people into prison. As you know, one author who did a study on this called it the new Jim Crow, the new form of slavery in our country. And it's alarming, and it should cause all of us who purport to be men of justice, freedom, and equality to start looking at these numbers and addressing them and speaking out very clearly to politicians, to legislators, even in our churches, to let that to let it be known.
Let me ask you two things. One is states have used a lot of inducements to bring these prisons to their states. They've given them tax breaks. They've given them land reduction costs. They've given them all types of inducements to bring them to the states under the guise of, as what they always say, creating jobs. And you touched on this, but I'd like for you to elaborate on a little more. They talk about A, creating jobs, and then B, that they're going to recover all of the benefits that they gave the companies with taxes and all types of other things, the business that's going to develop around the prison. How effective has that been? Well, let me start with that. How effective has that been?
It's not been particularly effective. You know, during sort of the big buildup in the prison population beginning in the 1980s or so, leading up to, you know, the subsequent 40 years, there was a lot of small towns, small communities across the country who were trying to outbid one another to get private prisons and public ones to be built in their communities with the idea that these institutions would bring employment. What we have learned is that hasn't really panned out. Private living in a prison town, whether it's private or public, isn't such great news for the town. Most of the people who these institutions hire actually don't reside in the town, because you're generally looking for people with certain skills, backgrounds, and the folks who work there don't choose to live in those towns because they don't want to be near the prison. And so the economic benefit has definitely been muted, and I think has disappointed a lot of communities who anticipate a prison being sort of this economic boom to their small towns. I know in particular at the federal level, where there are members of Congress who work really hard to get a prison, a federal prison sited in their communities, the Bureau of Prisons then has a real hard time recruiting staff, because often these prisons are sited in very rural communities that don't have therapists, you know, psychologists, psychiatrists, dentists, the kind of medical staff that are critical when you are housing a thousand people in an institution.
You know, let me just jump in real quick and say, as a anecdotal point, Bernie Sanders did a town hall in West Virginia, and one of the things that they talked about was they built a number of private prisons in West Virginia, and the whole selling point was it's going to create all of these jobs for these former coal miners and all these folks. But they found that most of the West Virginians who applied for the jobs didn't qualify because they had opioid crises. They had serious drug problems.
Mm-hmm.
And when you just mentioned that, that Bernie Sanders thing came to mind. And so just the whole point is, a lot of instances where they're using these pitches and using these ideas to sell the concept of the private prison to the community, it doesn't pan out for the community.
Yeah. I mean, real economic revitalization requires investment in communities that isn't about prisons. It's about providing people access to medical care and substance abuse treatment, education, quality education that allows for people to go on to higher, to community colleges and four-year institutions. You have to skill your workforce. Jobs just can't, you know, building a prison isn't going to be the answer to unemployment rates. We need to be investing in people, not in prison.
Bishop Stallings, what does this say to you that the country is so focused on incarceration, not even rehabilitation? What we've seen in this country, there was a time when the model was a rehabilitative model. In fact, you know as well as I that the whole idea behind the penitentiary as it was created in this country initially was a place of penance, and that by prayer, one would be reborn and one would be renewed. We have now gone to a model of strict incarceration, where now the likelihood of you coming out a better person than when you went in is greatly diminished. Your thoughts, what does that say about this country?
Well, one thing about this country that claims to be the land of the free and the home of the brave, it is quickly becoming the antithesis of that. Whether we're looking at, what's going on with the privatization of our prison penal system, or even when it comes to immigration. But the reality is it's going to take more than prayer. And you stated very well, Dr. Leon, you gave us that etymological derivation of the word penitentiary, because it was about through prayer and doing penance that people will be reformed, these prisoners will be reformed. And we know that does not happen without a very strong, consistent plan of rehabilitation to prevent recidivism. That's why the recidivism rate is so high, because there is no rehabilitation. It's trying to figure out how we can get them back in prison to make more money. And what America has to face up to is that for it to be a nation where so many people are in prison, where so many people are sent to the death chambers, America being the eighth nation in the world for the number of persons sent to the death penalty and executed, America has to really search her soul and to ask, are we trying to create an environment where we can really strengthen society by reaching out to that element that it deems as corrupt or criminal or weak, and finding out how do we really rehabilitate people to a point where they can be productive citizens, putting more money into these prisons, especially the privatization of prisons, is making the wrong people more wealthy. That allows them to have more control over the destinies of people who do not have the means by which to protect themselves or to raise themselves up. America really has to ask herself, is she really a nation where she wants to set the pace for the rest of the world, to be a model of freedom and justice and equality for the rest of the world? Or are we so becoming so insular, so isolated, and so self-centered, and thinking that we're better than anyone else, any other nation? And yet, when you look at what we are producing, when you look at how we're not seeking to elevate those who have gone the wrong way and giving them another opportunity to find the right path, we're not focused on that. We're not great. And it's not making America great again. It's making us more sinister, more diabolical, and more self-serving.
Cara, in closing, talking about your report, Capitalizing on Mass Incarceration, U.S. Growth in Private Prisons, I'll basically throw the same question to you, but with a slightly different twist. And that is, again, when we look at the history of prisons in this country, we go back to the Walnut Street Jail, I think, in Philadelphia was the first prison. The whole idea of prison at that time was penance and prayer for one to be redeemed. And now we have moved into the age of the private prison. And you had some data here that said that between 2000 and 2016, the number of people incarcerated in private prisons increased 47%, while the overall population increased 9%. Then the population reached a peak of 137,000 in 2012, declined to 126,000 in 2015, and now it's rising again. And so what does this say to you? What does your research say to you about where we're going with incarceration as a country?
I think it's saying that we're not doing enough to really tackle the issues of mass incarceration. I think, the president yesterday had faith leaders at the White House to talk about the need for prison reform and the importance of reentry. I think that's not enough. I think we need to be much, as a country, at both the national, the state, and the local level, we need to talk seriously about what it means to have mass incarceration. What is the consequences, not only on the individuals who are behind bars, but on their families, their children, and the communities they leave behind? It has devastated communities. People become disconnected. Their safety nets and their family networks are dismantled and disrupted. And you have children growing up without their parents, and that has lifelong consequences. And so we need to be much more aggressive in the policy change that we seek. We need to be much more open about the racial disparity that persists throughout the criminal justice system and dismantle that. We need to recognize that the solution to our social problems, poverty, racism, mental illness, and substance abuse and substance use disorders is not going to be solved by a prison or a jail. These are real issues that require significant public investment and serious thought about how we can tackle these problems, because we have decades of incarcerating more and more people has not gotten rid of drug abuse in this country. It's not gotten rid of mental illness. It hasn't gotten rid of poverty. They continue, and they continue at full tilt. I think the only way to address the prison privatization issue and the mass incarceration issue is to get at the underlying causes of crime and disorder within communities. And that means investing in communities and investing in people and recognizing their human dignity and giving people the tools and skills they need to address life's challenges.
Kara Gotch, co-author of Capitalizing on Mass Incarceration, U.S. Growth in Private Prisons. She's with the Sentencing Project. Thank you so much. And Archbishop George Augustus Stallings from the Imani African American Catholic Congregation in Washington. Thank you as well. Thank you all both for coming on the Critical Hour. Looking forward to having you back.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. With Northern California ablaze, sea ice melting, sea level rising, and 100-year floods and storms happening now every 50 to 25 years, for U.S. climate justice activists like my next guest, the Poor People's Campaign is really the only game in town. He's a writer and climate activist and joins us to discuss his latest piece, Climate Genocide, Why the Poor People's Campaign Should Demand Trump's Impeachment. Patrick Walker, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Hi, Wilmer. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, just fine. Thank you. Let me ask you, what's the relationship between climate justice and the Poor People's Campaign? I mean, this reminds me of people telling Dr. King that there was no relationship between the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War?
That's a good question. One of the things, you know, that I think was really important about Dr. King was that he connected the dots so well, mm-hmm. had such a compelling analysis, you know, of how the different issues were connected. I mean, just for example, you know, taking that example of the Vietnam War and say, like, working on poverty. Just the expenditures that you make on a war like that, like in that case, it was the Vietnam War. But in current days, like if you want to talk about the Russiagate narrative or America's eternal war in the Middle East, I mean, it requires an amount of spending, you know, when we're going to be needing to make huge infrastructure expenditures related to climate, related to adapting people to it, related to the kind of justice that you have to do in the nations where people who didn't cause the climate problem are the ones, you know, suffering the gravest consequences. I mean, that's simply unjust.
You know, that's a fabulous point, because I read, and I can't now pull up the piece off the top of my head, but for example, people in California consume more gasoline in a week than just about every country on the African continent, and there are 53 countries on the continent.
Yes.
The disproportional use of resources and then the subsequent contributions to carbon emissions and so on and so forth are so disproportionate. It is amazing. So, you know, what really interested me about your piece is that you're not so much focused on the science of climate justice. You are focused on the politics of it. You write, to avoid frustrating readers intrigued by my purposely inflammatory title, I'll pass rapidly over what climate justice's fierce urgency of now adds to the Poor People's Campaign narrative. Talk about why you feel that the politics of climate justice was worth writing about.
I have a pretty simple answer for you on this. As far as the science goes, very few laymen are really qualified to talk about it. And I mean, that's one of the extreme problems that I have with the climate denialists. You know, whenever they want to argue with me, I just always ask them, where is your PhD in climatology from? What peer-reviewed papers have you published and how many times have they been cited? I mean, the science of this is like essentially a matter for the experts. I mean, certainly as a layperson, I know certain things. I know that the average global temperature, has been trending upwards for a long time. I mean, I know about the glacial melt and those things, but I'm not an expert in any sense that the scientists are.
I know that I can go to Glacier National Park now and not see any glaciers.
Well, that's right. People are starting to have direct personal experiences of these things. And I mean, in a lot of cases, it's unfortunate that they're not, because, of course, they don't understand as well without the direct personal relationship. But what bothers me is the hypocrisy of trusting science in all other matters. I mean, are these people questioning quantum mechanics? Are these people questioning relativity? Obviously not. It's pretty clear, that there's, they rely on science all the time. And challenging climate science selectively is really hypocritical on their part. And I think Naomi Klein, really captures the problem well. In This Changes Everything and also a few of her essays, she talks about how for the right wing, climate action challenges their entire ideology, because it requires aggressive use of government. There's really no solution to the problem without active government. And if your ideology excludes that, you simply can't accept science that dictates that.
Just today, or maybe yesterday, President Trump is now looking to reduce the auto standards, the emission standards, the mileage standards, and the motivation, as it is stated by his administration, is it'll make cars on average about $2,500 cheaper. But what they don't seem to factor into their statement is, when you start impacting mileage output on a vehicle, that means you have to spend more money on gas and carbon emissions, the long-term impact of that. So their science is flawed. Their policy is incredibly flawed.
I mean, it's off the charts. And that's exactly why, rather than waste my time, developing a bigger amateur, grasp of the science, I think my time is much more fruitfully spent addressing the politics, because basically, that's the only place that we're going to do anything. I mean, that's the big holdup right now. And even a major climatologist like James Hansen, knowing how bad the problem was, he retired from NASA. He was the head of the meteor or the climatological division at NASA, but he retired from that position specifically so he could focus on political activism related to the science, because he knows, if we don't change the politics, humanity's cooked.
So why did you see, and you laid this out, I think, fairly clearly in your article, explain to the audience why you see such a direct relationship between the climate genocide and the Poor People's Campaign?
Oh, well, okay. Well, I mean, there are several different aspects involved in that. Let me take them one at a time. One of the things is, and this is a point that Naomi Klein really highlights, the only way we're going to solve the political problem that's blocking climate action is by building a big coalition. And the coalition has to involve, people who have other issues. I mean, obviously, for everybody, climate isn't the foremost issue. It's something of a luxury and a privilege if it is your foremost issue. There are people worried about where their next meal's coming from. There are people, you were talking about mass incarceration before, certainly a problem, you know, for black people, for people of color generally. I mean, that's certainly a problem. And like, if we don't, you know, if we don't address those problems for them, they're not going to have the luxury of focusing on climate. And yet at the same time, it's not a luxury because, you know, we all have skin in this game. That's one aspect of it. But another, you know, another reason, and this is what I was getting at with the genocide talk, is that, you know, in just about any kind of catastrophe, you know, I mean, if you take Hurricane Katrina, you know, or, you know, the storm in Puerto Rico, I mean, if you take those situations, it's always the poorest people and particularly people of color who suffer, you know, first and worst. And, you know, that makes this, to my mind, like specifically an idea for the Poor People's Campaign, because, you know, I mean, there's like climate change is already so baked in, there's inevitably going to be suffering. And, you know, the poor people of color are going to be the people, you know, on the front lines of it. But, you know, we can prevent like deaths and displacements by the hundreds of millions by taking action as soon as possible. So, I mean, in effect, the continuation of a policy like Trump's really is genocide.
You're right. So when a climate justice activist like me, emboldened by Chomsky's lifelong courage, outrageously asserts that Trump's climate policy is planned climate genocide of the dark-skinned poor, Poor People's Campaign supporters should first and foremost ask themselves, but is it true? Not how will it play with the media, prominent politicians, and the public, but is it true?
Oh, I mean, I think the evidence is really solid that it's true. And I link to a few studies in my article, you know, and I linked to just a few. There are actually numerous ones. I mean, one of the things, you know, that I think of, like, not directly in terms of death toll, but one of the things that I think of is the number of refugees. And what I've heard is that the World Bank is a conservative organization. You know, they're not bleeding heart liberals. The World Bank has estimated that there's going to be, I think the figure was 143 million climate refugees by 2030 and something like 250 million by 2050. And, you know, those refugees, when they're focusing on them, they're focusing on places like Africa, they're focusing on the Middle East, they're focusing on South Asia, you know, which is, you know, places where poor people of color live in huge numbers. You know, so just taking, you know, that particular figure, like just the displacement. But I think I've also, I think I've also seen a figure, I can't remember the exact date for it, whether it was something like 2000, it might even be 2030, come to think of it. I think 2030, there's a prediction out there for 100 million deaths due to climate already by 2030. And, you know, that's without, like, Trump's worst policies kicking in and being continued. You know, that's just based...
So does that mean people dying from storms and floods and hurricanes and tsunamis and that kind of thing?
Well, you know, some of it's indirect. Like a major factor will be droughts causing famines. That's, you know, so I mean, it's from a number of causes. It's not from any single thing.
Gotcha.
But you're also right. Like, major storms, floods, excessive heat. You know, which is really supposed to be a horrific problem.
Is happening in France right now?
Oh yeah, and I mean, in Quebec for that matter. You know, pick another speaking place. I think I was just reading there's something like 70 plus deaths due to a heat wave this summer because these people don't have air conditioning.
They don't have air conditioning, right.
There was no reason for them to have air conditioning until recent times.
So when someone is finished reading your piece, what are the three things that you want them to come away from your article understanding?
Let me see. That's an interesting thing. I don't know if I broke it down to specifically three, but let me.
Well, give me what you got
right here. Okay. Well, one of the things, you know, that I want people to understand is that this really is, you know, a political issue, and it's an issue stemming from our dysfunctional political system. Like, there's corruption, and not just the corruption of Trump's Republicans. I mean, it's also the corruption of Democrats involved in this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a corrupt system that's giving us this crisis, and it's the reason that a mass movement is the solution. You know, like movements, I forget what book it was I was reading. It was a book called Political Action, and by a political philosopher. I'm trying to think. It was the 60s. It was from back in the 60s. But, you know, it discussed, like, the difference between movement politics and normal politics. And basically, it talked about how movement politics exists for times when the people in power just refuse to listen, and basically the media supports them in their refusal to listen.
And we're finding that, to your point about this, this is not merely a Republican political issue. We're finding the refusal to listen from the Democratic establishment, who are really now just being pulled by their teeth into listening to the progressive sides or elements of their constituency. And the same thing with the Republican establishment. They are refusing to listen as well.
That's right. And, like, I mean, if you look at the problem, you know, I mean, I've thought of it from different viewpoints. I mean, one of the useful ways to talk about it is the good cop, bad cop analogy. You know, that basically the Democrats are the bad cop, you know, I mean, the good cop in this pair. The Republicans are the bad cop because the Democrats talk a good game, you know, and they pretend to be
the friends
of the people in all this. But, you know, when it really comes down to action, I mean, and, you know, regrettably, like,
they still voted for a $717 billion defense plan.
Yes. Thank you for picking a splendid example. Yeah. You know, and I mean, like, if you put that in terms of the Poor People's Campaign, you know, one of Dr. King's triple evils, militarism,
mm-hmm.
right there, you have it. I mean, and, like, so much of that is, like, not, you know, not just useless, but at this point counterproductive, because, you know, when you talk about the climate justice movement, one of the things you're talking about is the preconditions needed for people to be able to work on the climate problem. And, you know, part of the one precondition is global peace.
Mm.
People fighting wars, you know, and, you know,
Don't have time to worry about the storm.
Yeah, exactly. They don't have time to work together on climate issues. And I mean, if you look at, for example, you know, the whole Russiagate matter. I mean, Russia is an important nation to be talking to in all this because Russia, you know, is a petrostate.
Mm-hmm.
An awful lot of their income, you know, comes from oil
and natural gas.
Yeah, oil and natural gas. Right, and we have to find some way of weaning Russia's economy away from that. And, I mean, that has to be a collaborative effort. That's not just going to happen on its own.
Exactly. I got to stop you there. I'm up against the clock. But, Patrick Walker, thank you so much for your time. Climate Genocide, Why the Poor People's Campaign Should Demand Trump's Impeachment. Patrick Walker, thank you so much for your work and look forward to having you back on the Critical Hour.
Oh, I'd be delighted. Thank you, Wilmer.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik, and I got to thank my folks on Facebook. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.